The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2016 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2016. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at accsedu.org.
My name is Mary Ellen St. Cyr, and I've been in education for over 30 years, and mainly nutrition is all on nutrition education. I've been a principal and also a classroom teacher. And in the year 2000, I was somewhat disenchanted with the state of education, so I decided to start school. Not really an entrepreneur, but it's something I felt God called me to do. I started school in Frederick, Texas. It's down to 10,000. I had been living in Atlanta. I've only been to Texas for a short little trip, so I'm not a Texan. I'm really from Chicago. So it was a real adventure for me. After about 2 months of deciding to start school, I was 41 years old, and I met the man that I would marry. He and I had been single for all of our lives, and then became in contact with one another through some homeschool and friends, and they introduced us to one another. So we started Amplified Schools International, the network of 18 schools that developed on the philosophy of Charlotte Mason, who was such a great educator. And so, I'm going to share with you about the transformational process of narration. And Charlotte Mason talks about narration in her six-volume series on education, but really it's an age-old process. It's something that when you hear the fathers of old tell this to your children, that's narration. And so we're going to share with you how that is an effective way of being used in the classroom that transforms actually the method of the lesson. So you have two texts with you, one from literature and one from science. Oh, I forgot I had a microphone. I have a voice that projects, so I can actually stay with that most of the time. So the way we begin, I got a little confused there. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about narration. Charlotte Mason defined narration as a power. Now just think about that word power. I mean, I've taught for years. I've taught younger grades, I've taught middle school, and I've taught high school. And students need power. Teachers need power. The lesson needs power. And so she says it is in every person and it is in a child's mind waiting to be discovered. It is what the mind does naturally. Let him narrate, and he will, fluently, copiously, and in an ordered sequence, with fit and graphic details, the student tells back what was read. Letting a person narrate is providing a pause after a single reading of an episode for someone to tell back what was read. Narration is retelling. It is not memorization. It is not parroting. It is not word for word, but point to point. It is a type of essay response to a broad, open-ended question, a recall using the author's language, detailed in an ordered sequence. Charlotte Mason says there are universal laws which govern learning, and she at times called these laws divine and said she said we must get at them in order to educate. Attention is one such law. And we are living in an age where we are talking a lot about inattention. And attention governs learning, and all learning begins with attention. What you give attention to, you know. Narration is foundational to directing and securing attention. What would a classroom look like if the students knew at any time they could be called upon? It wasn't the ones who just furiously raised their hands that were called upon, but it was everyone. And everyone was called upon many times during the lesson. Do you think there would be more heightened attention? What would it look like in a classroom if the teacher leaned in to the students who naturally didn't want to tell back? What would their relationship be with learning, with the text before them, with you, with their classmates? The intellect requires a moral impulse. This is another law. And we all stir our minds into action, the better if there is an implied must in the background. For children in class, the must acts through the certainty that they will be required to narrate or write from what they have read, with no opportunity of looking up or other devices of the idle. I took a semester at St. John's in Annapolis, and there, too, you are required to talk. And as you sit around a table with 12 persons, you have to participate in every class, and the teachers look to you to participate. They don't call upon you, but they look to you. And then they talk to you about your non-participation or your participation because they want you to get at talking about the learning. Okay, that was all so new to me because I was a good student, but I was the kind who sat in the back and let the other people talk. I'd listen to them, etc. But guess what? The correlation between participation and learning is high. People who talk and write about what they know remember what they know. And so some of you might be talking in your mind or to your spouse or to your friend or other students, but it's really important to talk about it amongst the class. And so narration provides that. It provides that law, that need to pay attention or give attention, and that moral impulse. We had a new student in our school. He was in sixth grade. He had gone to traditional schools, and I happened to be in the class when he said this, and I was quite amused. There's always these delightful times when people just shout things out, and he was one of them. He looks around, and then he just shouted out, "In this school, everybody's paying attention all the time!" And, you know, I just smiled. And I thought how true that is. You know, we go in and out of attention. And also, teachers try to get our attention. I tried to get students' attention. This is going to be on the test. What did you say? What's going to be on the test? More questions. Why? I've directed their attention towards something that will happen in the future. The test. The all-important reason for learning. So working in accordance with these laws, the steady attention of children of any age and in any class in society is ensured day in and day out. It is not a matter of personal magnetism. For hundreds of teachers of varying quality working in home school rooms and in elementary and secondary schools, using this method secure it without effort. Neither does it rest upon the doctrine of interest. No doubt the scholars are interested, sometimes delighted, but they are interested in a great variety of matters, and their attention does not flag in the dull parts. Sometimes in education, we divide learners. I'm a history person. I'm a math person. I'm a science person. And so we're really animated in those subjects of like. And yet, here Charlotte Mason is saying that you will be interested in a variety of subjects. Elsewhere, she calls this whole world our great inheritance, and you must participate in it. But what happens when we have a child of a very young age and we already tell him, "Oh, you're my math person," or "You're my little basketball player," or "You're my literature person," "You're my artist." They move in one vein and stay in that sphere. And Charlotte Mason said, "The whole world is open to us as our inheritance. Take it. Reign and get dominion in it." Children no more come into the world without provision for dealing with knowledge than without provision dealing with food. They bring it with them, not only that intellectual appetite, the desire of knowledge, but also an enormous and unlimited power of attention, to which the power of retention, memory, seems to be attached as one digestive process succeeds another until the final assimilation. Now, it's only been recently that people balked at that. I remember talking to Susan Schaefer McCauley one day, and she said she was visiting here in the States at one of the schools that I was working at, and she said, you know, you all talk a lot about inattention here. We don't seem to have that in England. I said, but you will. I said, because it's part of our environment. And so when we think about that, is that children come in the world. Think about the last time you saw an infant in a mother's arms. Think about the child and how that when you came forth, they looked at what you were wearing. They smiled. You connected eye to eye. They had a word of glee. And think about children as they grow from infancy until 6 years old. 1,000 questions, interested in everything. I remember when I had my little nephew who was interested, there was construction in his neighborhood, and he was interested in all the front loaders and backhoes and all these things. And he knew all the language. I checked out a book in the library on trucks because I didn't know the names of these trucks, and I wanted to have a conversation with him. So I had to gain knowledge of that. And he was 4 to 6 during that time. But he had knowledge that I didn't have. So saying that is they have some provision children do in this world. Sometimes they lose the provision because we've given them some other kinds of things to give attention to. I'm not here to speak about that problem. I'm here to show you about narration. The behavior of mind is as the children's meals are with regard to physical work of digestion. Let us consider the behavior in a few aspects. The mind concerns itself only with thoughts, imagination, reasoned arguments. It declines to assimilate the facts unless in combination with its proper food. It, being active, is wearied in the passive attitude of a listener. It is as much bored in the case of a child by the discursive twaddle of the talky-talky teacher as in that of a grown-up by a conversational twaddle. It has a natural preference for literary form, given a more or less literary presentation. The curiosity of the mind is enormous and embraces a vast variety of subjects. We don't have to dumb things down to talk to children. Baby talk was developed by adults, not by babies. For the last 25 years, I have either been a teacher or have been working with teachers who have been working in accordance with these laws of attention and intellect day in and day out. Without much effort, narration is an essential power in education. It is a power that calls the learner to attention and then to a pause that provides this time of assimilation. In turn, the assimilated ideas serve as food for the mind. Effective narration depends upon both student and teacher and the quality of the text given attention to. Narration, in turn, becomes the ground plan of a student's education. So we're going to demonstrate narration. It's not exactly the way we do it in a classroom of 16 students. And so I'm going to ask some persons to narrate after we read the text, and I'm also going to ask some people to read the text. And so what I want you to understand, this is a demonstration, and so we would appreciate you actively involved. So I'm not going to call on you. Does anyone else need some papers? We have some extras now here. There's some here. So if you have a voice that can project, I'm going to ask you to read. And when you read, I want you to read slowly and carefully. I often have to slow myself down as a reader because I had grown up with the habit of reading silently. And then when I became a teacher, I just realized I was reading way too fast. So I will demonstrate how slowly we want you to read. But before we begin, I want to share with you some vocabulary that you're going to meet in the first 3 paragraphs. Okay, the word dump. This is the story of my life is from Helen Keller, the woman who was both deaf and blind, and it's the day that she meets her teacher, Ann Sullivan. So this is chapter 4 in the book. And the word dumb is used to mean that she cannot speak. Honeysuckle was a bush that was broad and fragrant, And it receives its name because it is nectar for the hummingbird, and it reaches down and gets at the flower. And then we're going to have the word langur. So let's pronounce that together. Langur. And then sounding line and plummet, which are terms of the sea on ships. That a sounding line was the line that you would use to get to the depths and to measure depths. And the plummet is the weight that is on the end of the line. And it has a point and shaped like a cylinder with a point. So that will help you in the understanding of this text. So I will read the first paragraph, and then Bill, will you read the second and third paragraph? But we are going to pause. I think we'll try with just the first paragraph in narration, and then we'll read the second and third. The Story of My Life, Chapter 4. The most important day I remember in all my life is the one on which my teacher, Ann Mansfield Sullivan, came to me. I am filled with wonder when I consider the immeasurable contrast between the two lives which it connects. It was the 3rd of March, 1887, 3 months before I was 7 years old. Okay, turn your paper over. Who would like to begin telling back about the most important day? Yes, could you stand up, please? Anything else? Okay. Anything else? All right, so Bill, just try the next paragraph.
On the afternoon of that initial day, I stood on the porch, dumb, expectant. I guessed vaguely from my mother's sign and from the hurry to and fro in the house that something unusual was about to happen. So I went to the door and waited on the steps. The afternoon sun penetrated the mass of honeysuckle that covered the porch and fell on my upturned face. My fingers lingered almost unconsciously on the familiar leaves and blossoms which had come forth to drink the sweet feathers of spring. I did not know what the future held of marvel or surprise for me. Anger and bitterness had preyed upon me continually for weeks, and a deep languor had succeeded this passionate struggle.
So who can begin telling back about what happened on that afternoon day? Could you stand?
She was standing on the porch of her house and heard her mother moving around and signing to her and assumed that something important was going on. As she was standing there, she noticed the smell of the honeysuckle, the sign on her upturned face, and the leaves of the plants that were so common to spring. Around this time, she remembers being angry, but then near the end of it, the linger had sort of, I guess, calmed that anger that she had been feeling for the last season.
Anything else? Yes? right, in the next paragraph, Bill. She begins here telling us about this dense fog. Tell us back that part. So you think about Helen standing on her steps. What strikes you about how she's describing her inner feelings? Alright, let's read the next two paragraphs, and we will read them together. So, who would like to read both of these paragraphs slowly? Yes. Could you stand, please? Thank you.
I felt approaching footsteps. I stretched out my hand, as I supposed, to my mother. Someone took it, and I caught up and held close to the arms of her. So it comes to reveal all things to me, and more than all things else, to love me. The morning after my teacher came, she led me into her room and gave me a doll. The little blind children of the Perkins Institute had sent it, and Laura Richmond had dressed it. But I did not know this until afterwards. When I had played with it for a little while, Miss Sullivan told me slowly spelled into my hand the word D-O-L-L. I was at once interested. finger play and tried to imitate it. When I finally succeeded in making the letters correctly, I was flushed with childish pleasure and pride. Running downstairs to my mother, I held up my hand and I made the letters for God. I did not know that I was spelling a word or even that words existed. I was simply making fingers go in monkey-like imitation. In the days that followed, I learned to spell in this incomprehending way a great many words, among them head, cat, cup, and a few verbs like sit, stand, walk. But my teacher had been with me several weeks before I understood that everything had an end.
So I felt approaching footsteps. Tell me about that part. Laura Bridgman was the first person who was both deaf and blind who had a substantial education in English and could communicate. All right, turn your page over. And who would like to read this next paragraph? Yes, nice and loudly, please. So who would like to tell back that part where she was playing with her D-O-L-L? Thank you. So let's just take a pause and discuss this. What do you notice about Ann Sullivan in this initial meeting? In the initial meeting when she met Helen on the previous page. And who would like to read the last two paragraphs? Yes.
We walked down the path to the well house, attracted by the fragrance of the honeysuckle with which it was covered. Someone was throwing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over one hand, she spelled into the other the word water. First slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motions of her fingers. Suddenly, I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that W-A-T-R meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. There were barriers still, it is true, but barriers that could, in time, be swept away. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with light. That was because I saw everything with the strange new sight that had come to me. On entering the door, I remembered the doll I had broken. I felt my way to the heart and picked up the pieces. I tried vainly to put them together. Then my eyes filled with tears, for I realized what I had done. And for the first time, I felt repentant and sorry. I learned a great many new words that day. I do not remember what they all were, but I do know that mother, father, sister, teacher were among them. Words that were to make the world blossom for me, like Aaron's rod with flowers. It would have been difficult to find a happier child than I was as I lay in my crib at the close of that eventful day and lived over the joys it brought me, and for the first time longed for a new day. So let's go back to this part. We walk down the path to the well house. Yes?
Someone was drawing water at that time. And her teacher put her hand underneath the flowing water.
So how are the concepts of light and darkness woven in an interplay in this text? So I would go to my whiteboard and make a T diagram and put lightness and dark. But I'm not going to do that, but just talk openly. What are some of the concepts in which darkness was described and light through this whole reading? What did darkness feel and look like? What did light feel and look like?
Darkness was depicted by
So we're going to pause now, and we're going to talk about the lesson and narration. So what was happening in each of your minds while you were listening to other people narrate? And three people got the whole of that first paragraph.
But what did you notice about me acting as a teacher during that?
Yes.
Darkness and light, yes.
It's time to work with you.
And so now
Information has now become knowledge. This isn't just words on a paper that we had to read and, okay, yeah, Ann Sullivan, whatever, Mansfield, Sullivan, they have a name. And this is knowledge for your own sake. It's going to instruct your conscience. It's going to instruct you about a little bit about nature. Next time you see a honeysuckle and you see a strong fragrance, just pause and say, oh yeah, that's not great. It's going to inform your life. And now, does this just happen when I destroyed my life at home time? I have a science text too, but we're running out of time. But I might ask the power to see if we could, if there's a little break and, you know, if there's a room that's available, maybe we can have a narration example of science, because I think it's a very dense subject, lots of vocabulary, and you can see how we can move in that way. But we have about 5 minutes, so why don't we just, if you have any questions or thoughts, share. Yes. But what does it do to the student when you kind of push a little bit and I kind of, you notice I move my body always towards the person, you know, and go way back there. But as a classroom teacher, if this person was talking, I move towards them. And so I'm kind of creating a posture of authority. Like, I'm here with you. I'm going to be supportive of you, but I'm also connected with you. I know you can tell more. So when I ask, when I stay with you and say, is there anything else, what is that doing for you as a person? So I would say to the students, okay, this is what we read today. I'm going to ask about this, and I want you to end with, after Ms. Sullivan came, and you realized that everything had a name. So how long will your narration be? Someone just shut it up. Okay, so because we have this kind of minimalist
kind of, you know, we are pencil touch to paper, and okay, that's all, I can't remember anything else, and we're just really ready to, like, get rid of it. And so we try, now, whatever they give, I'm happy with. But when I'm working with a student in, say, any grade, and if they're a new student in school, or they're younger, I would read their last line, and then I would, or the last paragraph, or maybe three sentences, and I would read it, and then I would say, and then what happened next? Oh, I got it. And then I'd read a little more, and what happened next? I got two more. Okay, I did that five times with one student that I remember. He had about this much on his paper. He was in fourth grade, and he's, you know, I'm done, I'm finished. And then I read it to him, and I said, well, what next? Oh, okay. All right, I'm finished now. And then I read it, and I go, what next? I'm finished. And then I did that five times with him. And then I showed him the book. I opened the book, and I said, look, this is where you started. This is what you ended with, and this is what you said to me. I told the whole. I go, yes, you did. And he was elated. And so I help them along the way. Now, with written narration, you know, we might have some of these words on the board because, you know, we use them as an intro to the lesson. I would say, are there any other challenging words that you might need for me to spell on the board so that you can spell them accurately? Then they would be, so there could be 10, 15 words up there. One might say, I'm giving them the answers. Am I? No. I'm giving them the words that they're going to put. They can't just write the words in a sentence of their own. They have to include it in the text. And so I think that sometimes we have this exacting way. This is a work of digestion. This is food that's going to be coming. It's going to be used in your mind. It's going to be a part of who you are. I mean, when the seventh graders read the story of my life, and we don't have movies during school time, you think so? But we have an after-school movie time, and we show the Patty Duke black and white version of this of Helen Keller. I mean, I was there as a principal, but they were so we had played basketball with students, ordered pizza, watched the movie, and then we had a discussion of the movie. And but prior to the discussion, when the movie ended, all of them unanimously stood up and gave a standing ovation to a black and white film. That was so beautiful. And the enjoyment was so heightened for them. And then parents started coming in, it was like 10:30 or 6 till after school. They go, and so different parents would come in and have some of their students, but it was really a beautiful thing, seeing mind of all of these relationships interconnected. That can happen not just with a beautiful text like this, it can happen in science, it can happen in other beautiful texts in history and other literature, those kinds of things. So it's a method that you can try in your schools, and you can see that it could be advantageous to heighten learning for everyone. Yes.
I'm assuming that in the upper grades, like third or fourth grade, that when they, you could do a couple of times kinds of written narration, you could say, well, you can look at your history card, your Bible card, and want you to rewrite what it says or what you heard, or do you always tell them to turn the paper or the card over?
So that was something Charlotte Mason had insisted on, one reading. If I give you another chance, if you underline, if you take notes, you won't know. And so we're developing the mind. It's an exercise. And so you start out with this much. I mean, you're new to our school. Other students are. I mean, we have first kindergartners who have written 2,300 words in a narration. Did they write it with their little hand? No, they had someone scribe for them. We have exams. Exam week in the fall and exam week in the spring, and students are examined 5 days beginning in grade one. Grade one through three, all the exams are scribed for them. people come in and type, your students tell me back. They don't know the question, they don't know what exams on what day, and they're just telling back. Now, of course, in the older grades, there's some more synthesis, there's more of an analysis. They might be asking to contrast or compare or use this to do this. But in the younger grades, they just tell back. And it's a skill that they're developing. And so we have students who've gone to medical school, and I had a gal tell me last summer, she sits in her room and she gets her books out, she reads it out loud, she closes her book and she narrates it. She says, I am getting that, using that skill all the time. So it's something to do to help you to have that information turned to knowledge. Now, some people's minds have a note to you. I don't have a mind that's this way. That they hear something, they read something, they see something, they know it. Information, knowledge. And that's a gift. That's something that they've been given. But for the rest of us, we have to go through the process of the pause, assimilating that information, taking it in, using that information, they can get knowledge. And that process is really that reciprocal relationship that's happening all the time in the classroom really shows a high respect for everybody. You know, when students hear so-and-so, I mean, when you only call on the little spirit students who are raising their hand seriously, you know, students are walking out of that class, I'm stupid, I don't know anything, I'm glad I'm good, hey, let's go play soccer, you know, that's what I'm good in, oh, did you see the picture I drew? We want them to have a relationship with knowledge, and in order to have that relationship with knowledge, they need to have a relationship, they need to be able to marry so that it's there for their own sake. Yes. There's other ways to use a book when you're older that you can ask them. Our students don't own the book, but we wouldn't allow them to highlight anyhow. But for example, when you're an older student in upper middle school, high school, college, you can use the book in different ways. You can use, after you've assimilated the information, you can use it to categorize it, you can use it to, organize it in a certain way. You can use it to make bullet lists of something. So we're not opposed to narration is not the only thing we do. Students learn to write essays. They learn to write different kinds of essays. So it's just the first step. So narration is the digestion. Now after you digest some food, then where do all those the enzymes that broke down the food and where does the nutrients of that food go? All throughout your body. The same with narration. Now you have that knowledge and now you can use it in different ways.
Did you call one student giving a hand volunteering?
Yes. In fact, in most of our schools, we don't have them raise their hand, these are callers. The teachers keep exacting lists. Okay, I call the new 6 students in Bible, the next 6 are going to be called on the next day. Because we don't want someone just to have their favorite subject, you know, oh, I narrate well in this subject. So we really want to create consistency across the lines of learning. Yes, I would have called on you, plus we wouldn't have such a large group. So we train students to say, I don't know. If you don't know, if some students say, I have a lapse in attention, okay, we're okay with that. But we're not okay with that all the time. So then students are trained to say, will you get back with me? You know, so the next time they know I'm going to be calling on them. Or I will say, I'll get back with you. So it still holds them accountability. So it's not like, oh, I don't know. Oh, great. I don't have to narrate till next Tuesday. No. You're going to have to narrate in a few minutes. Yes.
What if they narrate inaccurately?
I usually don't do anything to class self-correct. So the students say, oh, it wasn't really exactly that. And then the
then they fill in that piece, and someone else says, I think she needs to get something, and they fill in the one that came ahead of that. So it doesn't really get ordered. So then I have to come back and say, okay, you're right, all those pieces are necessary, so can someone give me first, middle, and last, beginning to end, so we order them.
And if they're consistently skipping the middle, I would shorten the narration. Because then, I mean, in science, you would narrate probably a paragraph at a time. Lots of language want us to really get at it, and so they can't. I mean, our students in grade 7 would be able to read that whole text and narrate it, well, all of it. And they wouldn't have any of the breaks, and they would be able to do that. But they've been doing this for 8 years.
So if this is this case, would you narrate verbally first and then have them narrate?
Yes,
very much so.
And also, yeah.
Would you ever play with narration? Because you're required to have so many ways and remarks in narration. You know, that something you take on.
So we assess. We don't grade. We don't have grades in our school. We don't have numbers or letters requirements. So we assess. And we have a report of growth. That's progress. Progress is different from growth. And so in assessing them, we would assess them for length. Length is the language, detail, order, sequence, and we would comment. So we would write words in the margins and say, I felt like I was reading that, you know, Helen Keller's words all over again. I mean, I want to, kind of what Carol Dweck says, the woman who wrote the book Mindset, she's from Stanford, who talks about the growth mindset. If I could say, good job, great. They don't know what's good job or great. But if I said all the details made me feel like I was reading Helen Keller again, they go, wow, good attention to detail. If I say good use of color, oh, use of color is important. I'm directing their attention to what's important. So I give words and language to describe what they are good at. Well, they're in books. They're in, we don't have notebooks, but we have a paper folder book that they write them all in. Yes. We have rubrics on narration, but we don't get 90, we don't get percentiles or numbers or letters to be ever described.
Probably about 3 or 4 months.
Okay. Well, if it doesn't work well, we're getting over it.